Welcome back to the Reverse Alzheimer's Summit. I'm your host, Dr. Heather Sandison, and I'm so pleased to introduce you to Dr. Dan Goodenow. His research into the biochemical mechanisms of disease started in 1990. His curiosity about the biochemistry of life is as insatiable today as it was then 30 years ago. In those 30 years, Dr. Goodenow invented and developed advanced diagnostic and bioinformatic technologies, designed and manufactured novel biochemical precursors, and identified biochemical prodromes of numerous diseases, including Alzheimer's. He also has studied Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, stroke, autism, ALS, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression, cancers like colon cancer, pancreatic, ovarian, breast, lung, kidney, liver, and stomach. He is just getting warmed up, and you can see why I'm so excited to have him here today. He's now going beyond disease. His new focus is to defeat the entropy of aging by creating strategic biochemical reserve capacity such that the human body can maintain the physical and biological functions of life indefinitely and without disease. That is a tall order, but one that I know everyone here is excited to hear more about. Dr. Goodenow, welcome.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sandison. And yeah, it sounds like a tall order, but like all big projects, they start one brick at a time. And
right.
And as you break things apart into their individual components, the complexity becomes less and less. And aging, Alzheimer's, neurodegeneration, most of these things seem so insurmountable because we look at the whole picture all at once. It's like having a messy house and don't know where to start. And then if you say, you know what, I'm going to start in one room and I'll get, and then by the time you're done, you know, it doesn't look the same as it did when you started. I think aging and these complex diseases, they overwhelm us because we think of them once they're here and we don't really understand how we got here. And we don't look at how do we get to this level of neurodegeneration? And the human body is designed to work. And I think people throw out all the basic logic that they use in their everyday life when it comes to their health, because health feels like a black box. You know, how does my heart work? How does my brain work? How does this, it's all so foreign, and the words that scientists use and the technology is, people just shut off. They can't think about it. It just feels so far beyond them. And then they just kind of wait for something to happen, and then they wait for someone to tell them what next. And so my background is in science, and my PhD is in psychiatric medicine, looking at the biochemical mechanisms of disease, and built a lot of technology looking at what causes disease. And you know, you don't walk down the street and get hit by lightning and have colon cancer the next day, right? There's a prodrome. There's a period where you become at risk for a disorder, and then that risk eventually translates into, you know, clinical manifestation. And so the question really becomes is, where does this all begin? And then to do that, you have to understand how the systems are designed to work in the first place, and then work from there. And so Alzheimer's is an interesting story. It's one of the, you know, benchmark or beachheads, if you will, of this preventative medicine, regeneration, restorative model, because it affects so many people. And it's such an emotional disease. You know, you get cancer, yes, obviously it's bad, you die, but if you die of cancer, at least you die yourself of cancer, right? When you die of Alzheimer's, you don't even die as yourself. It's a very, very tragic disease in terms of not obviously for the person suffering from the disease, but all the caregivers around them. And so understanding this disease is, you know, very, very important. And, you know, reams and reams of data have been generated over the years. So my contribution to the field really is looking at those biochemical mechanisms and understanding, you know, is this just a one-way street to death, or can these systems be rebuilt, regenerated, restored, and then obviously can we prevent them from degenerating from the first place? And Alzheimer's, people think about the brain, and they have a lot of misconceptions about how the brain is organized and how the brain works. And they think, in a sense of complexity, that it's not. is that people think the brain is like a computer, but the brain really isn't like a computer. It's more like the wiring harness of your car. Okay. It's a bundle of wires that connect different pieces. And just like the wiring in your house, where you have the copper wire in your walls that are protected by a protective sheath. And then you have a light switch on your wall that connects these wires. And so your brain is like that. And your brain is like a beach ball. And the outer part of the brain, the surface area, is the largest surface area. And that's where all the connections typically take place. And then in between those, you have these fiber, like the wiring harness of a car. And that's typically when people talk about white matter and gray matter. The white matter is the connectivity, like for autism and multiple sclerosis type diseases. And then in diseases like Alzheimer's, where we're dealing with typically synaptic function, but it's not that cut and dry. It's a little bit of both. And so neurons and Alzheimer's deal with a very specific part of the brain, but all neurodegenerations are not isolated. People who have Alzheimer's have other neurodegenerative disease issues as well, right? People with Parkinson's will have Alzheimer's like issues and so on and so forth. So generalized brain health is still generalized brain health. But the key of the human brain are those two components. One is the wiring, the complexity of the wiring that goes from A to B. And then there's the connective part. And the scientists, you know, we call the white matter, the fiber bundles, if you will, the wiring bundle. That's like the corpus callosum. It's what connects the two sides of the brain. And then the switching is your synapse, where the two neurons connect with each other. And that's biological. Those are living cells that do that. Like, it's not like copper and metal that's in your car. These are living things. These are things that we regenerate even all the time. So they require a supply of materials. They require a supply and, you know, diffusion. And so Alzheimer's, cognition is fundamentally a disease of one class of neurotransmitter, and that's called acetylcholine. And that's what the brain has, a bunch of these different types of wires for different purposes, just like you have wires for your taillights, you have wires for your car engine. And one type of wire, which is these cholinergic wires, are the ones that are more involved with our cognitive ability or executive function, memory, and so on. And these neurons require a certain type of electricity. You know, what goes through these wires is a molecule called acetylcholine. And so people take, you know, acetylcholine drugs like Aricept, for example, that extends the activity of that neurotransmitter in the switching plate, the synapse. But that acetylcholine is what connects the two parts. So when you flip a switch on your wall, you're physically connecting two wires with that switch. It's either disconnected or it's connected. But of course, your brain is biological, and your brain moves neurotransmitters across this little gap called the synaptic cleft. And it's like having a shower head. Like when you have a shower head that has a multiple little outlets. And if you just turn your shower head off and on, off and on, off and on, off and on, that's kind of how a synapse works. It just pulses these pieces of things and they connect across. And that requires a lot of, and that's how the biochemicals go across. And the biochemical that goes across for Alzheimer's is called acetylcholine.
So I have a question there, because so many people have been prescribed Aricept, an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor. So it maintains more acetylcholine and that's enough, but this doesn't help. So if that's the explanation for what's going on, then why don't those medications help more?
Well, they help symptomatically. Okay. So the acetylcholinesterase inhibitors have been very reproducibly shown to improve cognition short term, but they don't change the fact that your brain is degenerating. And so then the question is what's the normal process? So basically what you're doing there is you're just juicing up the synapse with the acetylcholinesterase inhibitor. Okay. You're not changing the biology of it. And so I know, again, getting the weeds. So what happens though, is that what happens in the biological brain is that we get synapse release of neurons. So neurotransmitters are held in this little sphere called a vesicle. OK, Okay. And it's trapped in there. And there's a signal called a action potential that signals the body to release these neurotransmitters. And that's a physical, it's like a soap bubble, right? And it has to hit the membrane and the bubble bursts. And when it bursts, it opens up and it lets all these neurotransmitters go into the cap. Now, this is the scale at which the human brain does this is massive. Okay. If you take a look at if you think of each one of those vesicles was a grain of sand, okay, you have the same amount of vesicles in your brain as there are grains of sand in the Hoover Dam. Okay. That's how many vesicles you have in the human brain. It's an enormous number. And more importantly, those vesicles burst and reform at a Hertz rate of around 100, which is 100 times per second. So that means the Hoover Dam in your brain, all the sand, is bursting and reforming 100 times a second as you're listening to me speak right now. That's the massive scale of the human brain computing power. Okay, it's still from a Hertz rate, like you get a gaming computer. Okay, the human brain is still operates at a capacity almost larger than all computers combined sold in a year. Okay, that's how, and it allows the human brain to basically reach quantum mechanical capabilities. So when we create a thought, okay, when you think, you are creating a new thing from nothing. Like it's almost like a quantum mechanical process. And what allows you to do that is this large network of these vesicles bursting, neurotransmitters releasing, and then they combine into thoughts. And we direct our thoughts. So this is why we can decide whether to have a chicken salad or a steak for lunch, right? There's somehow we're able to move our consciousness using this power, and it's tuned, and we get better and better at it as we get older. Then we reach a point where we can't perform all these functions. So when we get into those issues, so the ability to actually form vesicles and release vesicles is a biophysical process. Okay, it takes actual biological molecules to do it. And these molecules are lipids called phospholipids, kind of like soap in your, and there's a special type of phospholipid called plasmalogens that are particularly important in releasing these neurotransmitters. And these are molecules that you decrease as you get older. And the other thing people think about, so Alzheimer's, people think Alzheimer's, there's usually three things that people think about. They think about neurofibrillary tangles, these little protein tangles that get formed in the brain. You get amyloid plaques, which is this extracellular formation of protein. And you get brain shrinkage. Okay, now the brain shrinks like a, when you take a grape and a grape shrinks into a raisin, it becomes dehydrated because what keeps a grape plump on the outside is the fullness of water inside that grape. Now, your brain is made of fat. Okay, our brain is lipids and fats and membranes. And membranes are what gives us the compartmentalization. So when your brain shrinks, what you're doing is you're losing the fat of your brain. Okay, that's what you're losing. Like a grape loses water to become a raisin, the brain loses fat and membranes to become a shrunken brain. And so that's a physical loss. You're actually physically losing matter of the brain. And it's a shrinkage process. So the question is why? Why are you losing these molecules? Are you not making enough of them? Are you consuming too many of them? Are they being broken down too fast? And so that's the critical component. And the other part people forget about, there's basic operational fundamentals. The human body is made of membranes. And so when we talk about compartmentalization, you want to be able to do certain things in certain areas, just like in your house, right? You have things you do in the kitchen, things you do in your bedroom, things you do in your bathroom, and you compartmentalize those activities. And you compartmentalize those activities with walls. We even compartmentalize greater. We compartmentalize things that we do in our house that we don't do at work. And we have buildings. And so our world has compartmentalization in it. The human body has the equal level of compartmentalization. But again, it's biological. So all these wooden walls and steel walls that we build around us, our body makes those things, but it makes them with biological material. And the material that the body uses is called phospholipids. And phospholipids are this fat, basically. They're like soap. And they have a polar head group on one end and a non-polar side chain. And they organize into what's called a phospholipid bilayer. And it's basically a wall. It's a biological lipid wall. And that's what gives your body the ability to compartmentalize why your heart is separated from your brain. And then even inside, like when I talk about that wire in your wall, you have that coating is separated from the axon on the inside. And what separates those two things are these biological membranes. These biological membranes are made of phospholipids. Plasmalogens are one of these phospholipids. Some of these phospholipids we get from our diet, like our phosphocholine. Choline is a big thing. We get it from eggs. We get it from sunflower lecithin or soy lecithins. Choline is a critical nutritional molecule. Technically, you can
talk about acetylcholine. Yeah. And then now this is the phosphatidylcholine, which is in the membranes. And so are those related to each other? So if I'm eating more eggs, right, that choline is really important for multiple reasons.
Yes. And so this is a fact that most people don't realize. All of the neurofibrillary tangles of the human brain that form in Alzheimer's are caused by inhibitions of a biochemical system called methyltransferase. And this is a system that your body uses to make choline. So choline technically is not an essential nutrient, okay, in the list of from whatever organization gives you the list of essential nutrients, because your body can technically make choline, but it's energetically demanding to do it. And if you don't make enough of it, your body starts scavenging other things for it. And so when people
think methyl donors, it sounds like as well, because this is a methyl transferase. So if you don't have enough of those carbon and three hydrogens, then it's also going to be a struggle.
Absolutely.
To produce choline.
And this is why high levels of homocysteine, if your doctor talks about homocysteine levels, right? You want to keep your homocysteine levels low, not artificially. You don't want to fake it by like a lot of the blood testing. There's supplements that you can take that will arbitrarily lower homocysteine. But homocysteine is a very valuable biomarker because it indicates how much your body needs or is deficient in it. And so choline, like phosphatidylcholine, like from egg lecithin, soy lecithin. The other one that's important is creatine. Good old-fashioned creatine is another thing that we use for muscles. Our brain uses a lot of it, but that's also a big drive for methyltransferase. So choline is in your membranes. And choline is also used for Alzheimer's and the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. And this is what makes Alzheimer's so unique versus other diseases, because it uses a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. But choline, the molecule part of it, is such an, it's in all of our cells. So when you talk about Parkinson's and we talk about the dopamine system, well, dopamine is a unique molecule. It's only found in the dopaminergic neurons, and it has very specific proteins that only recognize dopamine. So when you take L-DOPA for Parkinson's, it's only affecting these neurons related to Parkinson's. Alzheimer's, the choline system is all your neurons have choline in them. Okay, but they have a selective, so you have this strangeness with Alzheimer's in that the neurons, they don't take up their neurotransmitter. Like when a Parkinson's neuron, like for a dopamine neuron, when it releases dopamine, it takes dopamine back up. When it recharges itself, dopamine leaves, dopamine comes back. Alzheimer's, that doesn't happen. What happens in Alzheimer's is acetylcholine leaves, does its work, it gets broken down, and then choline comes back. So it actually, and then it remakes, it actually resynthesizes the neurotransmitter in that neuron, which is very different from, you know, depression or anxiety, people dealing with serotonergic system, or people hear about the noradrenergic system. The cholinergic system is a very unique system. And it's unique because it has a special protein called the choline high affinity transporter. And I'm getting the weeds, but this is what brings up that neurotransmitter. What's weird about Alzheimer's is when I mentioned that process where the vesicles form and release the neurotransmitters, that membrane fusion process, the protein that brings the choline back in, that allows that neuron to recharge itself for the next pulse, that protein is actually on the vesicles that gets formed. All other neurons, that the reuptake protein is just sitting there. Okay, in Alzheimer's, the reuptake protein is on the vesicle. So anything that disrupts vesicular formation starves the neuron of choline, and we get what's called autocannibalism and shrinkage. So membrane fusion is one of the most critical components, and it's for all neurons, but the Alzheimer's neuron is most sensitive to that. And plasmalogens are the molecule that are used for membrane fusion. And so it's obligate. Membranes can't fuse together without plasmalogens in them. And we lose plasmalogens as we get older. because we can't get them dietarily. So all these other, and you have lots of them, 20, 30% of your entire brain lipids are these plasmalogens, and you make all of them. Because if you eat a nice, healthy, say, oh, wow, I got lots of these plasmalogens, right? So if I'm eating animal products, I'm eating fish, I'm eating this, I should be getting plasmalogens, right? But that's not true, because a weirdness of their structure, like they're designed to be sacrificed. So they have like a little fuse in them called a vinyl ether bond, and it blows up. It will, the body makes these plasmalogens so that it will get consumed and protect other types of molecules. So you make lots of them, but then you use a lot of them. The problem is that when you eat them, they're acid sensitive. So as soon as they hit the stomach acid, the acid in your stomach, they burst up. So when you eat a plasmalogen from a fish or from an animal or from whatever, very little of that actually gets into your blood supply. So there's very little nutritional availability of plasmalogens. So your body must make them all. And the body can make it from anything. Like it can make it completely from scratch, not dependent on any dietary selective molecule to make your plasmalogens. But problem is, you are now dependent upon your own biochemical synthesis. And it's made in a very special organelle called a peroxisome. Okay, so some of you may have heard about peroxisomes. People take fibrates for, people talk about high triglycerides when they're trying to get their triglycerides lower. Okay, so again, for Alzheimer's, you want to make sure you keep your triglycerides, your fasting triglycerides under 100. That means your peroxisomal function is working. So people that have low triglycerides and high HDL usually have good plasmalogens. Those three things kind of go together in your blood testing results.
What I notice is that people who eat a lot of sugar tend to have higher triglycerides. And as they reduce their sugar intake, those triglycerides come down significantly. Have you seen the same thing? And do you find, is there a correlation between sugar intake and plasmalogen synthesis?
Yeah. So what happens is, okay, so when we measure fasting triglycerides, okay, when your doctor says, hey, let's get a blood test and look at fasting triglycerides, they're not measuring the triglycerides you eat. They're not measuring the olive oil in your cupboard or, you know, whether you're eating bacon fat or not. Okay, what you're actually measuring is what your body is making. Okay, you're actually measuring your body's synthesis of triglycerides, because that's what your body makes to store for later. So when you have a meal, okay, you have two, your body has two gears. You have the fed state and the fasted state. In the fed state, I've just eaten a big meal. My stomach, my intestines are full of food. They're digesting proteins and fat and carbohydrates, and they're sending all this energy into my blood supply. And it's far, far more than what I can use at this point in time. Because of my liver, and the liver says, whoa, I cannot possibly use all this stuff. So I'm going to store this stuff for later. And so what they'll do, what your liver does then, is it packages the extra energy on triglycerides. Good old oil. Exactly the same chemical structure as the oil sitting in your cupboard. Okay, that's what your body makes, exactly the same stuff. And it sends it to your fat cells for later. So after a meal, your triglycerides could be like 1,000. Like your blood could be white with fat. Okay, that's normal. Okay, well, not maybe normal, but it's possible and it happens all the time. But then after a period of time, your intestines, all that food that you've eaten gets digested and burnt up. Okay, and at some point, you've run out of that energy that you've obtained from your meal. And now your body has a switch from this fed state to the fasted state. When it shifts to the fasted state, your fat cells become your stomach and your intestines. And so your body starts digesting that stored triglyceride in your fats. And it sends this energy, again, to your cells, your body, your liver, and this and that. When it gets to those cells, and those cells can't process it, okay, they're weakened, or you're diabetic because you can't have your sugar issues, then your body says, hey, I can't even process the energy that I'm sending from my fat cells. And so your body starts remaking triglycerides and sending them back. So when triglycerides are over 100, that means that your energy of your cells, your cellular energy capacity is impaired. And it's usually either peroxisomal or mitochondrial. So to your question of sugar and diabetes and high blood sugar, these are systems of reduced glycolytic capacity of your cells. It means your cells can no longer process glucose properly. And so glucose builds up. And since the glucose builds up in your blood, your body says, oh, I can't have that. And so your body starts pumping more and more insulin. It says, well, I'm going to start pushing this I'm going to start pushing this glucose down. And that's what insulin resistance is. Insulin resistance is simply caused by your cells being unable to process glucose. And so your glycolytic capacity is low. So it could be peroxisomal, could be mitochondrial, but your energy is bad. And so fasting, exercise, all these things, better diet that reduces your glycolytic food supply. So that those, all those things, they reduce the glycolytic load of your cells. And if your cells can now process the glucose that's there, then all of a sudden there's less glucose in your blood. There's less requirement for insulin, and insulin resistance disappears because you don't need insulin. You're no longer insulin resistant because you are actually digesting, you're processing the glucose that's coming in. So all that goes hand in hand. So people like that are on ketogenic diets, or more importantly, the intermittent fasting, is very, very important, because that allows the body to build. And peroxisomes are your building cells, organelles. Mitochondria are your burning cells. So your body works like your iPhone cell. Like during the day, you're out running around, your phone's unplugged and it's busy, the light's bright and it's doing this and it's doing that, it's checking this and checking that, it's on whatever you're doing on your phone, right? And it's burning up energy. It's not doing background checks and making sure everything's ready. Then the day ends and you plug it on your charger, the light goes off and it starts recharging. Okay, that's your fasting state. Okay, the human body is designed to work during light hours, okay? And then at nighttime, when we're not supposed to be eating and we're not supposed to be, you know, we have this caloric restriction, this natural caloric restriction that occurs during our day. And that body, your body switches to the fasting state. And when you're in the fasting state, you're running on fat energy, triglycerides. And that's when you build your hormones, all your hormones are built, your membranes are built, your plasmalogens are built. So your fasting state is really critically important. So this intermittent fasting, or at least having only one insulin pulse per day, okay? And so if you have to snack, have non-insulin sensitizing snacks. And, you know, I always tell people to skip breakfast. Like if you can wait and have your first meal at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, that's the best way to getting intermittent fasting. Skipping breakfast is the best way to get that. If you can get all your calories in like a 6 to 8 hour window, it's one of the most healthy things that you can possibly do to your human body. And it does it because it actually helps make these plasmalogens, okay? And get these plasmalogens into the brain. The other thing that people miscalculate is cholesterol. Cholesterol's got a really bad name. The other really critical fat for all your membranes is cholesterol. And people with ApoE get really freaked out about this, the ApoE genotype. But, you know, when people get cholesterol levels below, total cholesterol below 200 really increases your all-cause mortality, increases your Alzheimer's issues. You know, we talk about HDL and LDL, but these are the fats that are part of our membranes and our ability to keep all these membranes. So plasmalogens.
It's such a breath of fresh air to hear you say this, right? Because this is also the backbone of our stress hormones and our sex hormones and all of that signaling going to our brain. And when we're told over and over again, it's getting flagged at 200, even though the American Heart Association and the American Diabetes Association say that you do not need to have that under 200, your total cholesterol under 200, unless you have active heart disease or active diabetes. So there's a whole chunk of people who are being told by their primary care providers that they need to take statins because their total cholesterol is over 200, when that's not, no one is really suggesting that's a good idea if you look into it, but it's getting flagged anyways.
The lowest rate of all cause mortality in humans is cholesterol between 220 and 260, period. That's 162 countries, probably 30 million subjects, okay? As soon as your blood cholesterol, your total cholesterol levels gets under 200, your all cause mortality doubles, okay? Having
depression, right? Your background is in psychiatry. Depression, anxiety. When I see somebody's cholesterol at 140, 130, I just go, oh my gosh, how you're not producing sex hormones. You're not producing any of the things that are going to be necessary for you to maintain a healthy mood
and or
heal.
Exactly. And your HDL levels are really critically important. Getting your HDL above 50, it certainly should be above 60. When HDL starts dropping below 50, you know, if you're choline deficient, your body can't share cholesterol. Okay. Like HDL, like you have two cholesterol systems. You have your LDL system, which is mostly like kind of total cholesterol, is kind of a proxy for that. But that's a cholesterol system that distributes cholesterol. It's like I tell people it's like an energy grid. Okay, where you have a main power plant, and then you all the houses have their own little solar panels, right? So you have LDL system is the main power plant. It's sending cholesterol to all the cells of the body. And the cells, it doesn't push cholesterol. Okay, with the cholesterol in your blood is not being pushed on your cells. Okay, your cells will take the cholesterol that they want. Okay, like when your house, you take the electricity, the power company doesn't push electricity into your house. You draw electricity from the grid as you need it, okay? And your cells draw cholesterol from the blood supply as they need it, okay? And so that's what the LDL system, and it actually pulls it in, the LDL particles, because cholesterol is fat, right? Like, think about it. You can't take bacon fat and pour it down your sink, right? Because it's going to just clog up things. So what the body does is it puts all this fat on these proteins, which are highly water-soluble. And so they stick on these proteins, and that allows the body to distribute these fat molecules, because your body is basically water, right? Like, you have all this aqueous water system. So we use these proteins. One of these is LDL protein, LDL cholesterol. So LDL cholesterol is a big piece of water-soluble protein with a bunch of cholesterol stuck on it, okay? And it gets distributed. And your cells say, hey, if I need cholesterol, I'm going to pull cholesterol in. That's your LDL system. Now, your HDL system is when you make your own. This is, you have your solar panels, right? And you're saying, hey, I'm generating energy in my house, but hey, I'm making more energy than I'm using, because I'm not home today. My solar panels are still working, but I got no TV's on, nothing's on. So I'm going to donate some of my energy back to the grid. And so the HDL system is, you're donating it back in. It's saying, hey, I am so healthy. I am so energy efficient in my cells. I can actually share my energy with the rest. In the brain, it's really important, because your brain, your cells want to share their cholesterol with each other. And they share their cholesterol using the HDL system. And so if you have, so HDL is how you get cholesterol out of your cells and distribute it. And so that's your export. And the combination of those two things allows your body to tune. It says, okay, I can get higher or lower. So because all your cells are different, and you're different. It's not, you're even the three-dimensional, the sphere of your of a cell, there'll be parts of the cell that'll need more cholesterol than other parts. So it needs to be able to move that cholesterol around and share it around. And that's how it does it.
Take us back to ApoE, because with ApoE4/4 status, we know people have a 1 in 2 chance of developing dementia. ApoE3/4 is a 1 in 3 chance of developing dementia, way more than the average in the population, which I think is like a 14% chance. So there's a lot of confusion about what we know and what we don't know about ApoE4/4 status or 3/4 status, having one of those ApoE4 alleles. And what happens as it relates to fat synthesis? So we know that it puts us at risk for dementia, but fats, plasmalogens, are kind of these phospholipids. So they're half fat, half water soluble. Tell us how plasmalogens are related to this ApoE and then fat metabolism in general.
Yeah. So ApoE is a big pet peeve of mine. And it's in my book. I'll go through it in great detail for ApoE carriers, because there's a lot of work, and scientists love complexity, right? Like, it's like, how many angels can we put on a head of a pin? That's what we do all day long. It's like, we dig deeper and deeper and deeper. And if you dig deep enough, there's always something interesting to find. Okay. But for all of you ApoE4 carriers, okay, let me just describe in very simple form, because for Alzheimer's related issue, there's only one thing related to ApoE, and that is reverse cholesterol transport. That's it. 100%. Okay. So I just talked to you a little bit about these proteins that move cholesterol around. So HDL, okay, so the LDL, the main cholesterol distribution, is called apolipoprotein B, ApoB. And the main HDL protein is called ApoA. Okay, and so over the last 50, however many years we've studied these proteins, we've labeled them. Okay, now apolipoprotein B, your LDL particle, that particle actually gets absorbed by LDL receptors. It gets pulled in. So when you take a statin, okay, what statins do is they block your body's ability, your cells. What statins do is they turn off your solar panels. Okay, makes your solar panels don't work. So it's like turning them off. So the only way you can get energy or cholesterol in your cells is by pulling it from the grid. So by shutting off your solar panels, okay, we force the cells to pull all the cholesterol in from the LDL system. And by sucking all the LDL out, we bring LDL levels down. Okay, that's how statins work. Now, HDL particles, they don't enter your cells. They stay on the outside of your cells. Okay. They're, you know, the FedEx truck. They're waiting for the cholesterol to come out. Okay. When the cholesterol comes out, it'll take it out. So HDL particles cannot go in. Apolipoprotein E is very unique. It's ambidextrous. It can enter the cell. It has both LDL activity and HDL activity. It does both things. Now in your brain, what makes ApoE important is your brain uses ApoE for both LDL and HDL functions. So you do not have apolipoprotein B. There's no LDL in your brain. And there's very, very little A. Your brain basically uses apolipoprotein E. It uses it for both the LDL mechanisms and the HDL mechanisms. Okay, so it uses it for both things. So because your rest of your body is like an interstate highway system. I'm shipping things from Chicago to New York. Okay, the brain is Chinatown. Okay, the brain is a whole bunch of little streets connected by little, and so everything is local, right? And so you don't have these very big arteries moving things back and forth. And so the brain uses apolipoprotein E because it can use it for both things. And how it separates the different functions is that there's different proteins. Some proteins will bring in and some will out. So long story short. So now we have these alleles. So when you get ApoE in the brain, we have these different genetic mutations. So you have the E2 variant and the E3 variant and the E4 variant. And it's all related to this disulfide bridges, like this cysteine bonds. So proteins connect to each other kind of like two magnets on a screen door, if you will, right? And a sulfur in one and a sulfur in another, they'll connect. And the mutation that makes the difference between the ApoE genotypes is the ability to form these disulfide bonds. And it affects only one protein in the brain, just one, okay, is a critical one, okay? And it's one of the proteins related to cholesterol transport, reverse cholesterol transport. So what happens for ApoE4 carriers is that they have, so the difference between the ApoE genotypes is your ability to export cholesterol. So E4 carriers are cholesterol savers. They're not leaky. Their cells do not leak out cholesterol. And that's protective for other things like viral infections, bacterial infections. The reason why we still contain E in a genome is that it actually is a protective genotype. But as you get older, your compensation mechanisms for that cholesterol clearance becomes less and less and less. So that what was healthy earlier becomes unhealthy later. So a natural E4 carrier should have cholesterol higher, like because your LDL levels, because an E4 carrier holds onto it saves more cholesterol than the other ones. So an E2 carrier can't hold cholesterol for the life of them. So they're always leaking cholesterol. It's like a teenage kid with an allowance. They're just spending it every week, right? So your E2 carriers are just, they're making cholesterol and they're getting rid of it, And so they can't hold on to cholesterol. So that's why LDL levels in E2 carriers are always lower. And LDL levels in E3 carriers are kind of in the middle. And LDL levels in E4 carriers are a bit higher. And that's natural. So that's how it should be for them. Now, the yin and the yang of cholesterol export are these HDL protein or these protein export and plasmalogens. So the other thing that drives cholesterol export, called reverse cholesterol transport, HDL export, is plasmalogen levels in your membranes. Okay, so what happens, so what we published in a large population in Chicago was that plasmalogen levels neutralize the ApoE genotype effect on Alzheimer's. So an E4 carrier with high plasmalogens does not have an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease. Okay, it completely neutralizes that. And that's important. Genes don't do anything. Okay, genes have mechanisms. Okay, genes give us, I call it genetic adaptability. Okay, like people think that genes are deterministic and they're not. There is no such thing as a gene for a disease. Okay, there isn't. It looks like it, it feels like it, it sounds like it, it sounds so normal, sounds so logical. I have it, but it's actually not the case. We're born with with adaptability to our environment. Okay. Your genes have no idea what you're going to do tomorrow or the next 10 minutes. Are you going to eat a pint of ice cream or are you going to eat a steak? It has no idea what you're going to do. And so they have to sit back behind their little nucleus and they have little sensors saying, okay, what the heck are you doing to me today? Okay. And then they're going to adapt to whatever they experience. So we have certain genetic adaptabilities. And if your environment gets out of your adaptable windows, you get diseases. You can't. And so it's our responsibility to live within our genetic windows. Okay. Our genes can change to a certain degree. Like we can adapt. Like if you exercise, right, you're going to increase your oxidative capacity and your body's going to adapt to your changing environment. So you can do healthy things to increase your genetic window. They can say, you know what? I have more options available to myself now. Okay. My body can handle better adverse circumstances because I've trained it to do so. Okay. It's like having a basketball player that only shoots hoops. Okay. Yeah. All he does is go every day. He goes to the free throw line and all he does is shoot free throws. Okay. And you go, wow, look at this awesome guy, man. He can just shoot hoops all day long. Well, you put him in a basketball game and he's crap because he can't do anything but shoot hoops. He can't dribble. He can't move around. He can't pass. He can't block. And so we train ourselves out of these things. Okay. And so this is what bad diets will do. And so this is where health style things do have major events, but what they do is they keep you from becoming more and more narrow in your functionality. You're
describing the hormetic effect, basically, where we create a little bit of stress on the system, whether it's through calories or through temperature, like hot and cold, or even with oxygen. We can do this a little bit with contrast oxygen therapy. And as we ask the body to do more, it's capable of more. And we want to make sure that as we age, we continue to do this so that our cells have that, like you're describing, this dynamic ability to respond to the environment.
And you have to give people enough time. What I notice a lot with the athletes that I've worked with and aging, they think, oh, more is better. Okay. But remember, I tell people exercise is bad for you. Recovering from exercise is good for you. Okay. It's recovering from the stress. So you got to give your body enough time to actually recover from the stressor that you give it. So it's good to work out to complete exhaustion, to complete failure, but make sure you rest. Okay. It is that rest period that allows your body to recover and train itself, get prepared for the next long-term event. So anyways, we're getting off on all these things.
There's something that I have to ask you because it's one of the questions that comes up most often with my patients. And we've seen APOE4/4 carriers go on a ketogenic diet and have really great responses cognitively. And also that their lipid profiles look better. However, there's a lot of, I would almost call it like trepidation. As people learn more about APOE4/4 status or 3/4 status, and they think about eating more fats or getting on a ketogenic diet, and it particularly with MCT oils or coconut oils, there's a lot of confusion and questions around how these high fat diets might impact someone with APOE status, positive APOE4 status. And so what I hear you saying is, well, maybe we can just override that by using plasmalogens as supplementally, or is there, like, do we understand enough about fat metabolism in the brain that maybe this isn't as much of an issue as we thought? Or like, we can't break this.
It's the quality of the fat. Okay. It's very, very important. And so the ketogenic diet, it's important to use it for its correct purpose. Okay. So what you're doing is you're extending the fasting state. You're preventing fed states from occurring. And your body should have at least one fed state per day for the most, like you can go for a fast. You can fast for a week if you wanted to, like there's those things, caloric restrictions are good. Now, when you burn fat, you create a lot of acid. So the other thing with the ketogenic diet is people need to work on, they're not getting fruits, as many fruits and vegetables in their diet. Those things reduce the acidity. And so you need to make sure you should be checking, people that are on a ketogenic diet shouldn't just be checking their ketone status. They should be checking the pH of the urine. And they should be taking bicarb, and they should make sure that their electrolyte balances are maintained, your sodium, potassium, magnesium balance. And those are very easy. There's lots of supplements out there. You can take, you know, like an Alka-Seltzer Gold, there's a pH Aloe, there's supplements out there that give you bicarb. You want to, because when you're burning pure fat, you're creating a lot of acid, and that creates other issues for your body. It makes it hard for your body. So you want to make sure you neutralize all the acid that you're burning, creating from fat metabolism. So that's one thing when people get stuck on a huge ketogenic diet, they don't keep track of their acidity levels and keep their
eating tons of veggies, but it's not just.
And then bicarb, we live in a very acidic environment, good old fashioned baking soda, but you can get the potassium versions, and it's important to keep your acidity levels low. It helps clear things out of your kidney function better. If you're on a ketogenic diet and you're exercising a lot, then you're creating lactate and that other addition acidic environment. So you want to deal with that. Okay. And so one is the fat diet is fine. There's nothing wrong with that at all. Like anything in this world, you just need to deal with the right quality fat, getting the lecithins, phosphatidylcholine in your food supply, add them to your meals is very, very important, because these phospholipids, because just triglyceride is quite stressful. So you want good quality fat. It's just like good quality, like carbohydrates are not bad. Like you want complex carbohydrates. It's just, if you have too much pure fat, it's just like too much pure sugar. You're just replacing one, you know, evil empire with another. But it is healthy. So I'm a big, but you know, you want to be able to live. You want to create a lifestyle that you can sustain, right? When you're talking about longevity and you're talking about mental health, okay, it's not a diet that you can do for a month or 2 months. It's a diet you need to be able to do for 30 years. Right. So you need to create a lifestyle that is sustainable. It has to fit within your own personal environment. And you can't deprive yourself so badly that you feel that life isn't worth living. And so you have to create programs that are sustainable and logical. And that's, you know, because sometimes we get too fanatical about one thing and then we can't maintain it long enough for it to give us long-term effect. So, but the bottom line though, is what you just mentioned is 100% correct. When people get rid of the sugar intake, so this is another part, people, we don't measure, like you think science has everything figured out. We don't, right? And even if we did, you couldn't possibly measure it frequently enough in an individual to give them so much satisfaction. Okay. What happens when you shift to a ketogenic diet or a fat-based diet is that you are spreading your day out. Okay. And so your body isn't that smart. Like it relies on you to be smart. So when you have a meal, when you eat a major meal, okay, you first part of your meal, you start digesting food, and all of a sudden your body is experiencing all this glucose and things that it wasn't experiencing 20 minutes ago. And it has no idea whether you ate a chocolate bar or a 4-course meal. Okay, it has no idea at that point in time. So it starts pumping out some insulin. So, you know, I'm gonna get some insulin going here, you know, put this glucose out, right? And it's got to somehow predict how much food you're eating at that point in time. Now, if you just ate just enough sugar to elicit an insulin response, then that insulin works and it's still there and there's no sugar left. And that's why when people drop, okay, they get this post-insulin shock, hypoglycemic shock. And even if you're measuring your blood glucose levels, that doesn't mean you're not getting hypoglycemia in certain parts of your body that aren't being measured. Okay, it's not perfect science. And if you feel it, if you feel headachy and bad and all that kind of stuff. So when you get to a ketogenic fat diet, that actually spreads that out. So one of the big benefits of that is it prevents this hypoglycemia aspect. Because once your body switches to fat metabolism, it is happy. People think about this, like most of the day you're not eating. Okay. We don't eat 20 hours out of 24 hour day. Right. So your body mostly runs on stored energy. And what does your body prefer to store? Your body doesn't store glucose, store short-term, you know, it doesn't store complex carbohydrates. It stores fat. Okay. That's what your body chooses to store to eat later. Okay. It chooses fat. It likes fat. It likes saturated fat, actually. Palm oil. Okay, is the cleanest burning energy source of the human body. That's what your body actually makes to store for later. Okay, then it burns it later. So if you can think about what your body actually does, it stores fat for use later. So it likes fat. It likes to burn fat. It likes to run on fat. Okay. That's what it prefers over anything else. And so, yeah, so it's a good thing when people deal with these things, but you know, like all things in moderation. So anyways, so yeah, so all these health lifestyle things are important, but they only get you so far. Okay. Certain dietary supplements, vitamins, you know, there's certain nutritional components in our food supply, but there's a difference between nutritional vitamins and therapeutic supplementation of vitamins. Okay. When you take a B6 or you take 100 milligrams of, you know, of your B vitamins, you're getting a pulse and you're getting it into your cells and getting it to where it needs to go sometimes. So sometimes as we get older, we need these supplements. And so I like a balanced approach back, but for Alzheimer's, it's this membrane cholinergic system, plasmalogens. The methyl transferase system is critically important. Make sure that you have your homocysteine levels low and you get good quality fat, the phosphatidylcholine in your diet. And so I'm a big believer. We have lots of data on MRI. The brain can be rebuilt. Alzheimer's is not only curable, okay, it is reversible and it's preventable. It absolutely 100% categorically with no caveats. That is the truth. Okay. I've seen it with my own eyes. I've seen it in my own family. I've done it personally. Okay. So it's doable. It's absolutely 100% doable.
Okay. We see it here clinically every day.
Yeah. But it's not, it doesn't come free. No. It's not magic. Okay. It's actual systematic performance and understanding what you're trying to achieve. And you need to restore that membrane structure and function. Restore that cholinergic system. And then you have other things, you know, you change the lifestyle that got you there in the first place. And aging is aging.
So. What have doctors seen in terms of improvements when one of their patients gets on plasmalogens?
Well, dramatic. Like I get people that their lives are restored. Like we've published what was coming up. We presented at the Alzheimer's conference. We'll be publishing it now, it's coming out soon, but people with a late stage Alzheimer's, CDR3, okay, clinical dementia rating at the maximum level, they're down to MCI level. They're going from urinating in the closet to random, you know, being violent and being on the wandering to having a normal life, up in the morning, having breakfast. Okay. They're, you know, mobility is a big deal. We get a lot of improvement in mobility. What people see is first is the subtle cues. Okay. So as a scientist, okay, when we're doing clinical trials, okay, people have a hard time understanding when I put my scientist hat on, you're all lab rats. Okay. Like it's very selfish. It's for me. Okay. When I run a clinical trial, I run a clinical trial for me. Okay. I say, okay, what am I going to, I'm going to identify my inclusion criteria. What kind of people do I want in my trial? They have to follow these criteria. Okay. And then it's like high school. I'm going to compete. I'm saying who has the nicest dress at prom. So I want to have I'm going to say, okay, this is my selection of people that I'm going to test. Right. And then there's these standard tests that we have that are accurate, which is great. Okay. For us. So we can compare upon ourselves, your memory, drawing, and all these kind of things that we, these psychometric tests that we do. And then we use these as the common metrics for scientists to talk to other scientists about things. Okay. But for everyday people, it's all useless crap because it doesn't help you in your everyday life. So when people talk about their real life, what they normally notice is that the vision gets better. Like they get eye contact. They start seeing their loved one, their eyes get a little brighter. They get a little more engaged in conversation. Okay. They start getting up and answering the phone that they didn't get before, or all of a sudden they're answering the door, or they're engaging in their world. They're engaging, okay. And then things come, like they start remembering people, and like I have dramatic stories. Like my aunt, for example, she got to the point where she couldn't recognize her son, and she can recite everybody in her 50th wedding anniversary album right now. She's walking again, okay. And so these are things. These are real things. They happen to people. And so plasmalogens are a critical component, okay? And they are a big hammer. They're one of the biggest hammers we have in our, because it really has a huge association with reduced cognition. but also reduce mobility.
This has been in a liquid form for a long time, and I know there's a flavor kind of thing.
It's in a gel cap now. So
it's in a gel cap. Okay, great. So these are available in a gel cap. And how is this different? Because I know there's a cost difference between like a fish oil.
Right. So fish oil. Okay. So when you talk about your essential fatty acids, the things that your body, when I talk about membranes before and building all these walls, okay, you use, and your body's very smart in the sense that it uses things for multiple purposes. Okay. Fat's one of those things that uses for multiple purposes. It uses it for energy. You burn it into carbon dioxide and water. Okay. Like your body is essentially a hybrid electric car. Like we burn hydrocarbons to charge a battery. That's a whole different conversation. But so the essential fatty acids, so there's certain fatty acids that your body can make. You're saturated in this omega-9 oleic acid. You can technically make that and store it. There are certain fatty acids that your body cannot make. That is your linoleic acid, like your corn, soy, you know, canola. We get too much of that as a general rule, but it's very critical, it's still important. And then we have our omega-3. Okay, so omega-6 is your linoleic, your omega-3 is your linolenic, like flax oil. And your body uses that to make a complex long chain fatty acid called DHA. And that DHA is your fish oil. Okay, but your body makes your own DHA. And what DHA is, it's a very long molecule with a bunch of double bonds, makes it kinky. Okay, and so what it does, when it fits in that membrane, when I talk about the biological membrane, it makes it fluid because it breaks up the structure a little bit and keeps the structure from getting.
Yeah, and back. So it's a wall, you need a high integrity wall that can decide who comes in, who goes out. And this makes it more, there's less of a decision there. So more is coming in and going out without.
And you have different memories. So DHA, your fish make DHA, and so do we. And so of all the animal species out there, the fish oil has high concentrations of this DHA molecule. And so if you eat fish oil, you get this DHA, and which is important because it's energetically demanding for you to make enough DHA. Plasmalogens are not DHA. Plasmalogens are that backbone. Okay. They're what the DHA is attached to. Okay. So plasmalogens, DHA is attached to the plasmalogen backbone. And so we actually make two types of plasmalogens. One is the DHA plasmalogen. That's for membranes. That's for that switching plate concept. The other one is the omega-9, and it's designed for multiple sclerosis and autism, very powerful for improving sleep at night. And it's an anti-inflammatory. It's designed for that white matter. It's for the protective coating. It's for the signal transductions. So people have to think about, when I talk about this wiring harness concept, I also tell people you can think of your neurological system like a radio, and an old radio, right, where you have the dial and you're tuning the station. And the fiber that contains the signal, okay, that is like tuning it. So if you have like a multiple sclerosis and autism where you have this when you have inflammation, you have static. Okay, when it's like static, it's like the station is not tuned. The signal is not going clean. It's leaking out. And when you have a statically, you know, if it's not moving properly, if you turn the volume down, you can kind of hear the music behind the static. Okay. But if you turn the volume up, all you hear is static. So when you want your neurological system to work properly, once you get the signal tuned, then you can crank up the volume as high as you want, because now you got the signal. So the white matter, okay, these omega-9, your oleic acid, olive oil type molecules, okay, those form this nice tight protective coating. And so that's what an omega-9 plasmalogen does. And that's what we designed for stroke and concussion and autism and serendipitously sleep improvement. So it's really powerful reducing neural inflammation. Mm-hmm. And then the DHA plasmalogen is designed for function. It improves the neuromuscular junction in synapse function. So They're very, very different. Okay.
Very. And then phosphatidylcholine is the other one that we talked a lot about, which you can take as a supplement. Yep. And so how is that different from plasmalogens?
So phosphatidylcholine it's phosphatidyl. So it's still a regular glycerol backbone. So there's two types. So all your lipids in the body, you can think of your lipids, your fat, like a power strip, like a power strip with three plugins. Okay, you got a power strip with three plugs. And if you plug in a fatty acid on all three, like if I put oleic acid, oleic acid, oleic acid, I have olive oil. Okay, and that's olive oil in my cupboard. And it's called a triacyl glycerol. So triacyl, so there's three acyl bonds. Okay, and that's what a regular triglyceride is. And then if you replace one of those three with a choline, a phosphocholine or phosphoethanolamine or another phosphate group, that's what creates a phospholipid. And so you have two fatty acids. So you still have two oleic acids. And then you have this polar group called choline. Okay, that's what a phosphatidylcholine is. So again, phosphatidylcholine is just like that's what the backbone is being attached to, a classic glycerol backbone. Plasmalogens, it's the backbone. It's that three carbon backbone that's different. It's a plasmalogen backbone. Okay, it has an ether bond. And that's what your body has to make that you don't get from your diet. And so phosphatidylcholine provides that choline molecule and lipids. So that's why those phospholipids are different. So plasmalogen, so the plasmalogens that we manufacture are plasmalogen precursors. Okay, they're designed to enter the cells of your body so your cells can make their own plasmalogens. Okay, so it goes into the cells of your brain, into the cells of your muscles, and those cells then convert it to the final plasmalogen. So it's like when people have experience with Parkinson's, when you take L-DOPA for Parkinson's, you're not taking dopamine, you're taking a precursor, because the dopamine won't get where it's going and has side effects. But L-DOPA will get into the cells, and the dopaminergic cells can actually make the dopamine they want, as much as they want. And so plasmalogen precursors have the same kind of design. They're called alkyl acyl glycerols. And they've been around for years and years and years and years. We've just made very pure forms of them, like old shark liver oil and those type of things. So alkyl glycerols have been around a long time. Wow. Lots of positive aspects. But the problem is the supply of it in the environment. Like if I take shark liver oil, there's squalene, there's a bunch of other, and you can't get the actual type of plasmalogen you need. So that's why we make pure omega-3, the DHA plasmalogen, for performance, for neurological function. That's a critical one for the APOE4 carriers. Like you need the DHA because that's the reverse cholesterol transport one. But for people with autism and MS and sleep issues and neural inflammation, diabetic neuropathies, the omega-9, we call it protoglia, is designed to calm those nerves. It's a neurological calming. It improves the protective sheath of your neurons.
So I know our summit attendees are going to be really curious to learn more and also see how they can get the benefit. So where can they learn more about you? You have a book called Breaking Alzheimer's. I have it here, excuse me. And then you also have a company. So tell everyone where they can find out more about you and about getting plasmalogens.
So the company is called Prodrome Sciences. So prodrome.com is where products are available, blood testing, certain supplements, and even just general stuff. Then educational is at my drgoodnow.com. And I put a lecture series for Alzheimer's specifically. Okay. And I call it the definitive lecture series on Alzheimer's. It's like 12 videos and it's a long, like you gotta, you know, it's like an hour each. And it goes through each system, goes through nerve fibrillary tangles in precise detail, over 50 years of research of different things. I'll give you the epidemiological information. Worried about amyloid plaques, which is the issue with Alzheimer's disease. So for issue with APOE4 carriers. So APOE4 carriers have a higher propensity to get amyloid plaques. And then that amyloid plaque is in association. So I go through that in great detail, what amyloid plaques are and why. Basically, an E4 carrier who doesn't get increased amyloid has no increased risk of Alzheimer's. So amyloid is a kind of a biomarker of that E4 mechanism. So I go through that, brain shrinkage, mitochondrial function. So I go through each of these things in detail because a lot of stuff we talk about seems, you know, fantastical, but it's not. We actually have our level of knowledge of these diseases is very, very high. We know these diseases and we've known about them for many, many years. The problem is the implementation of this knowledge. into the general community. That's what, and that's why I've moved from being, you know, standing in a glass tower watching humans get sick and die. And so, you know, what we're doing now is we're getting more interventionists. Like, it's how do we systematically intervene in a scientifically valid, precise way? Okay. And that's what we're doing now on many levels. But yeah, you can go through that in great detail. It's however deep down the rabbit hole you choose to go, I'm happy to go there with you. But
yeah, but it's great to have that educational resource. Yeah. It's amazing. Thank you for creating that. Thank you for writing the book and then also making the plasmalogens available to people so they can start implementing relatively effectively and efficiently.
Yeah. And it's, you know, you get a good doctor on your hand, you get a good naturopathic doctor or a functional med doctor, and don't, you know, don't discount conventional medicine, but you start dealing with these, people have to realize the human body is designed to work. Okay. And you have to get people to get this age matching concept out of their head. It prevents the elderly people from demanding function of their body. Okay. You don't buy a 30-year-old car and say, you know what? It's okay. It doesn't need brakes. Old cars don't have brakes. No, it doesn't matter how old brakes are supposed to work, whether it's a 30-year-old car or a brand new car. Okay. Your brain is supposed to work. Okay. And you should ask yourself and you should look for function. Okay. And it doesn't matter how old you are, things are supposed to work. And if you have the expectation of work, then you have to say, what's wrong with my brakes? You know, same thing in your brain, your body, the logical structure of our human body is logically organized the same way everything in your life is. It just uses weird names and words and things and drugs and so on, but don't throw your own logic. Okay. People who've gotten successful through their lives by looking at things in a logical way. Don't throw that logic out the window when you start dealing with your health, thinking, oh, I can't handle this. No, expect it to work. And then if you expect success, you will find your way through it.
So. Yes, expect more, expect the body to heal. I love it. And yeah. There's a lot of hope out there with everything we know and everything that we're learning. Dr. Goodenow, thank you so much for joining us. This has been, I've learned so much from you and I know our attendees have as well. And I just couldn't be more grateful for your time and expertise.
Thank you. Okay. Welcome. Cheers.